Hi, listeners, and welcome back to this mini podcast series from Van Oord on climate adaptation and the work that we can do there to provide solutions for that. This is the third in the series. I hope you've had a chance to listen to the first episode where we spoke with our guest speaker, Karen Sack. She's the CEO and president at Ocean Unite. We had a really great conversation on the challenges faced by our oceans and coastal communities as a result of climate change. And I hope you also had a chance to listen to the second episode with Henk Niebuhr from EcoShape, where we really started to talk about concrete solutions in building with nature, which we can deliver to help coastal societies and be more resilient. So for this podcast, I'm really excited to welcome our next guest, and that's Peter van Eyck, and he's the program head for Deltas and Coast at Wetlands International. I'm really excited to talk with Peter about some really exact and specific solutions surrounding biodiversity and hopefully mangroves and wetlands, which we can offer to make coastal communities more resilient. So welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Rachel, and well, always excited to talk about mangroves and other coastal ecosystems. So look forward to this conversation.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you, and I think it's great for our listeners to really hear about these specific solutions which we can offer. So thank you for joining us. Maybe it's really nice to start with a short introduction from your side. What's your background? What makes you tick? What got you into this field of working, and what do you do at Wetlands International?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Peter van Eyck. I am a biologist by training. I specialized in tropical ecology. And well, already from childhood, I have a big passion for nature. That is what inspires me, what motivates me. And well, that's what I turned into my career. A very keen interest in nature conservation, not just looking at the biodiversity angle of conservation, but also looking at how nature is important for people. And well, essentially, that is what I'm currently doing as a program head at Delta and Coast at Wetlands International, working to conserve wetland ecosystems. So all ecosystems where you have water, these could be mangroves, mudflats, for example, seagrass beds, but also inland systems such as river basins and peatlands. And well, given their disproportionate value, well, we try to conserve them, restore them, and well, kind of maintain their full range of values, the biodiversity values of those systems, but also the value they have for people and for the economy.
Yeah, what an amazing and inspiring story that you could really take something that you're so passionate about and that's what you get to work on a daily basis. I think that's what all of us hope for in our life. So that's really nice to hear. Do you have a sort of highlight or something like a nice project that you've worked on that you'd like to share with us to give our listeners a sort of context of what the kind of work is that you do?
Well, that's really hard to say. It's a broad range of initiatives. What gets me really excited is our work on building with nature, but I'm sure Henk Niebuhr has already spoken about that in the previous podcast, bringing together engineering, ecological knowledge into integrated approaches. That really excites me. But to just give you a snapshot of some of our other projects, we also have recently started a very large global initiative on mangrove restoration, where we really try to work with local stakeholders, including private sector, to bring back degraded mangroves at a level that hasn't been demonstrated before, really upscaling small pilot projects across wider coastal landscapes. And then lastly, another initiative that really excites me is a remote sensing program that we're running, which is called Global Mangrove Watch. It's not entirely different from Van Oord's online platforms on adaptation, where we really bring together geospatial data on mangroves, their values, for example, for carbon, disclose that through an online platform so that policymakers and practitioners on the ground can use those data to inform their work. So, well, no lack of exciting projects and initiatives, and happy to talk about them a bit more.
Yeah, great. It's always nice when it's hard to pick what is your highlight.
Yeah.
And really, really nice to also hear that you are focusing in your projects on not only working with the local communities, but also using data and the science and technology that's becoming available to us to help us advance in these topics as well. So that's always really great to hear. And thanks for the reference to our tool. And I think that that's a nice thing to mention, that of course a lot of people are developing tools and using data, and we have a whole community and host of tools that we can use to help raise awareness and educate and stimulate the discussion on taking action on these kind of topics. So really, really nice highlights, Peter. Maybe to take a little bit of a broader step back, because I'm very excited immediately diving into details of specific projects, but maybe if you can paint for us a picture of the bigger global scale of what is happening with wetland ecosystems around the world, and where then do our focus need to be on, and why, and how is that connected, for example, with climate change and the impact on coastal communities?
Yeah, sure. So, well, it's not a surprise to hear that from a wetlands organization, but wetlands are super important for people and for nature, so they deserve being protected. They protect our coastlines, they store huge amounts of carbon, they provide fisheries resources, and then host unique biodiversity. But despite those values, wetlands across the world are in a really bad condition. Partly they are threatened by the impact of climate change, although wetlands also provide a protective role against the impacts of climate change. But we also see huge anthropogenic disturbances of wetlands around the world. Varying causes ranging from conversion for infrastructure development and expansion, pollution, of course, conversion for agriculture development. And, well, there's a very big need, actually, to bring those wetlands back into a healthy state so that they continue to provide resilience for people and for our economy.
Yeah, and that's a really critical element, and that should play a role in the work that we do going forward, which is a nice branch as well to the discussion which we had with Henk Niebuhr about building with nature as a program under the EcoShape banner, and why it's important to bring these ecosystems into our engineering as well. Could you say something about that? So what's this building with nature approach, and why is it relevant in this discussion?
Yeah, well, what you see in the world of engineering, traditionally ecosystems used to be seen as a liability, something that you need to look at because of regulations to prevent bad impacts of your project, but not necessarily as an asset. And I think what building with nature as a philosophy does is that it moves away from seeing as nature as something that is scary, that you need to fight, that you at most need to kind of protect, towards an approach where nature is actually part of your solution, and where an engineering approach that follows nature-based principles really looks at the wider system and asks the question, how can I maintain the functioning of that wider system, which is the interplay between the living and the dead environment? How can I maintain the protective values and the services provided by ecosystems and meet my development challenges by combining maintaining that natural capital with, where that is needed, adopting and applying more engineered solutions to meet specific needs? And, well, what you typically see is that such an integrated approach provides society at a societal level much bigger benefits, and often is also cheaper to implement.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's hard for a lot of people to get their head around, right? Because also immediately a lot of people naturally feel like the work that, for example, Wetlands International is doing, restoration of ecosystems, is in direct conflict with hard engineering infrastructure solutions. So building with nature is giving us this kind of other opportunity. How do you see that?
Yeah, very much agree with that. The engineering sector and the NGO community used to be seen as opposites. But I think where they sit around the table, there's actually much more common ground than you think. Of course, there are many engineering projects, let's say old-style engineering projects, where we as Wetlands International would get really nervous about, because they have a pretty nasty impact on the environment, sometimes also on local communities. But that said, I think there are also many examples where, if you identify a joint challenge for engineering in a given area, if you really bring the engineers and the social scientists and the ecologists around the table, that actually there is a lot of space to develop solutions that do not just meet your immediate engineering challenge, but that also, through the inclusive nature of your design, meet all kinds of other societal needs. And to give you an example of that, if you integrate a wetland in an engineered design, well, that wetland can, for example, support your hard structure, for example, a dike, providing additional coastal protection. But that same ecosystem also might store huge amounts of carbon. It might provide values for ecotourism. It supports local fisheries. So, well, really solutions that yield much more benefit than only a very narrowly defined engineering target that you might have set at the start. And I think, given the complexity of future challenges such as climate change, There is a need for much more integrated solutions, and therefore there is also a need for the engineering sector, the ecologists, the social scientists to innovate together and to really carve out a new pathway for infrastructure development.
Yeah, I mean, you explain it so beautifully, and what I'd be interested to hear from you is if you think that we're going in the right direction, because I think that indeed historically projects from a contractor's perspective very much dictated on how can we get the lowest price, and I personally really see a shift globally and a momentum to start valuing nature in a much more realistic way. What do the natural systems, also looking at the landscape scale and the societal value, how do we value those things actually, because in the end everyone loves to bring it back down to the dollar signs. Do you think we're going in the right direction there, or are there still things that we really need to do to make sure that this is the discussion we're having with every project?
I would say yes and no. I think within the innovation domain, also for example within the context of the Building with Nature Innovation Program, the private sector parties from the engineering sector have really done a fantastic job in developing Building with Nature principles, testing the approach, promoting it, and really creating a buzz around these solutions. And that has really contributed at some levels to increased intention for nature-based solutions, also at the level of international policy fora, for example. But then at the same time, of course, many engineering firms operate in a very competitive environment. They have to comply with client requirements. And actually, many clients are either not educated yet about the benefits of nature-based solutions, or they might have very specific needs that are not necessarily the same needs as we have as wider society. And well, there I see we really lag behind. I see that within the marine contracting engineering sector, there are still a lot of projects implemented that probably as society we shouldn't want. And on one hand, I understand the sentiment that if you as an individual contractor operate within a competitive market, that, well, you don't have a lot of choice to step out of your comfort zone. But at the same time, I would like to challenge the engineering sector to actually try to step out of that comfort zone more, either by, well, more proactively educating clients and maybe sometimes also taking a risk there, and by teaming up with other players in the engineering sector to kind of jointly raise the bar for sustainability of coastal engineering projects. And of course, there are good frameworks for that, such as the kind of umbrella organizations for the dredging sector, where actually there is quite a lot of space for learning and innovation.
Yeah, I think you touch on a really important element there. It's about awareness and educating, and not just within our small group of parties that are working together, but really in the broader sector, every client that we work for. We have to walk this road with them and educate them. And I think there are great resources out there and we are doing a lot of great work. But yeah, we need to share that and take those people along with us. And I do think, unfortunately, those things do take a little time. But I think steps have been taken. So yeah, I'm happy to hear that you're also highlighting it's about this education and awareness. And yeah, we're doing that, and better that we do that all together in a collaborative sense with all these different parties, then each party is trying to do that on their own with their own intention. So,
yeah, and every organization has to find a niche in that process. And that's why I really enjoy a collaboration between an NGO such as Wetlands International, a corporate actor such as Van Oort, that actually from your different roles, from your different positions in society, you can actually play a role in creating this enabling environment for nature-based solutions. I think as an NGO, for example, Wetlands International is really well able to operate in policy environments where we bring stakeholders around the table, inform policy processes, and really inspire adoption of nature-based solutions in policies and plans. But if Van Oort as a corporate would be very proactively voicing nature-based solutions, which you are already doing, actually that also sends out a message, because if, well, these kind of solutions are promoted from within the corporate sector, it's not anymore just the NGOs that want something new or something different. It's actually the private sector itself that is driving change. And, well, I think bringing these different parties together, jointly developing a vision towards adopting these kind of solutions and pursuing that together, well, that has inspired me a lot. Well, it also has learned me a lot to kind of align my NGO perspective with the ways of working, thinking, and doing within the private sector. And as I said before, I think there's much more common ground in finding joint solutions than we think.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And that we keep challenging each other, but that we have one clear voice and we will get there for sure. For sure. So maybe it's really nice and something that I think is also important for that education and awareness element is that people like to see real examples. So I think we've just released a book of concepts from EcoShape, which we've contributed to, and I know Wetlands I've had a role in as well. And that really shows some real specific examples of what you can achieve in coastal and delta environments with wetland solutions. But yeah, that's what people also want. They want something tangible to hold on to, or to help them understand what is possible. So let's have a move the discussion to what are real specific examples that we can share with our listeners here today that you could talk us through to help them also grasp what are we talking about here when we talk about these solutions.
Yeah, well, I think in the previous podcast, Henk Niebuhr already referred to the project in Indonesia on building with nature in Demak, right?
Just briefly, I would love to hear more details from you. Henk sort of touched on it. He touched on the mud motor and these kind of things. But I think the detail, if you can try to build a picture up for our listeners, that would be great.
Yeah, so we're talking about an area in central Java, the north coast, not far from the city of Semarang, which used to be, and to some extent still is, in a really desperate situation. The mangroves that used to protect that area have been chopped down to make place for aquaculture farms. And there's real big problems with soil subsidence due to water extraction and disturbance of sediment flows along the coastline due to all kinds of infrastructures that interact with the sediment flows. As a result of that, it's an area that really suffers extreme erosion. Up to 2 kilometers of land have been washed in the sea, along with entire villages, and about 60,000 people in that area are awaiting that same fate if the situation is not resolved. Well, there had been pilots in that area implemented by different stakeholders to apply traditional infrastructures to protect the people in that area against these problems, but they didn't really work along that muddy coast. So the little dams that were built sank in the mud, disturbed the sediment balance even further, and the situation got more and more severe. And then in association with the Indonesian government, a number of partners from the EcoShape Consortium, including Wetlands International, teamed up to work with local stakeholders, and that included government authorities, but also local communities, private sector, to actually develop an integrated approach to resolving the coastal erosion issues in this area. And again, in line with building with nature principles, the philosophy was, is it possible within the severely disturbed coastal systems to bring back the natural capital that used to make this area healthy in the past? And following an in-depth analysis of what was happening in that area, we defined an integrated approach where we combined the restoration of mangrove forests along the coastline with the application of salt marsh works, little permeable dams made out of twigs and tree branches that actually capture the sediment in front of the coastline and provide a substrate for the mangroves to grow. And these kind of green and engineered measures combined, alongside with a number of measures to promote sustainable shrimp farming and address the soil subsidence issues through policy dialogues, well, provided the basis for an integrated program along this 20-kilometer coastline to again make the people safe from these hazards. And that program started about 5 or 6 years ago, and we are about to implement, to finalize the first phase of implementation of this program.
What a great project and a really good example, because it touches on so many different aspects as well. The complexity that it was so many issues already contributing to the problem, and then the fact you needed to come up with such an integrated solution on a landscape scale rather than trying to address in each little pocket each individual complex issue. Really, really nice example of how you need to bring all the elements together and come up with an integrated solution on a landscape scale to really make something a success. I'm saying it's a success. So I assume we're all saying this project is a success, but how did the local communities react, for example?
Well, I think what is unique about the project and what also helped build the local community ownership is that we adopt very much a bottom-up approach to solving this situation by organizing, training and mobilizing local community groups to take measures to protect their coastline. So it was the communities that also engaged in the construction of the permeable dams. It was the communities that implemented the restoration. It was the communities that implemented all kinds of sustainable livelihood activities as alternatives to the harmful activities in the past. That engagement really created their ownership, support and involvement. And it really took some time to get them on board and to convince them about our approach. But while implementing this bottom-up approach, we also had more of a top-down approach where we brought in the international experts on ecology, sediment dynamics, economics, and where we worked on the basis of that system knowledge with communities and with a number of stakeholders from government to kind of bottom-up also develop a master plan for the area so that there is like one single plan that outlines, well, this is where we collectively want to go towards. This is the grand vision for the area. So then you have the master plan that creates your pathway, developed in a participative manner. And you have the bottom-up activities implemented by local communities to actually make the master plan see the light, to get it implemented on the ground. And I think that's quite unique because many projects are either very community-oriented or they're very high-tech, engineering oriented and often struggle to bring the community perspectives on board.
Yeah, and in that sense, this project really is a success story. You said now you're at the point where the project is being wrapped up. What does that mean? Does the community now take over and maintain this setup? How do you see that going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have signed all kinds of management agreements with the communities where we signed contracts and made agreements with them on the long-term maintenance of the structures that we put in place. The government of Indonesia will also provide sustained support to cover some of the maintenance costs. So we really facilitated an alignment with government contributions to local development and the communities themselves taking responsibility, taking charge. And what also will improve the sustainability is that the livelihoods activities that we implemented, such as organic shrimp farming, provide a very strong income base for the communities, well, to develop, to further materialize their ambitions for the area. And to give an example, by introducing the organic shrimp aquaculture as an alternative to a very polluting traditional aquaculture model, the income of local communities raised 3 to 5-fold. And that, of course, provides them the capital to keep growing and implement new activities. It's not that there's no challenges, because there is still a lot of subsidence in the area. It's also something we cannot directly address in our project, because this is a wider issue in the wider area that needs to be addressed through policy intervention. So there certainly are threats to the area that will sustain and that need to be resolved in order for the MAC to be safe in the future. But I think we can safely say that the model that we implemented has been very successful. And well, it is our ambition as part of the Building with Nature program to work with partners like Van Noort to explore how this model can be replicated elsewhere in Asia and in other continents, and how we can develop this way of working as a promising approach for also for developing countries in applying a more sustainable approach to their coastal development.
Yeah, and I think that would really be such a fantastic outcome of this project, that you show that this should be the approach elsewhere and what made it such a success and how you translate those successes into other projects. Something I would also like to loop back to, because we talked about educating and making people aware, and I think in this project in Demak that was also a lot about the local communities, because they had destroyed a lot of the mangrove ecosystem that was there. How can we also help people to understand the value in this case of mangroves, but of these ecosystems and the services they are delivering?
Yeah, so what we do with communities often, there is a basic awareness of why mangroves or other ecosystems are important for their livelihoods. And often it's outside drivers that caused the decline. In this case, it was the shrimp expansion that took place in the 1980s, 1990s. So external investors coming into these areas, essentially paying out local communities to turn those areas, the mangroves, into aquaculture systems. But in many cases, of course, locally, you also see that there is a lack of awareness about why it is important to conserve or restore. Well, what we do with communities, but also with other stakeholders, is have all kinds of meetings locally, workshops to make people aware about the values of those systems, inform them about it. But in our experience, what works best is to make people experience themselves why these ecosystems are so important. So in the MUC, we established what we call a farmer field school approach, where we trained local groups of farmers to apply this organic aquaculture model and to kind of collectively monitor the benefits of this approach in terms of the costs, in terms of the benefits, in terms of how environmental aspects, improvement of those aspects contributes to increased productivity. And then we asked those trainees to go back to their peers in the community to tell their stories and their experience. And then you really get a local learning process where one farmer teaches the other about why it is important to change a model of natural resource management.
That's very powerful.
And at that very low level, well, that clearly works much better than when I come from outside in this area and come with some story, rather than one farmer educating another farmer and then that going on and on and on. And we go as far as having communities from one village in Indonesia go to the other side of the country to tell their story. And well, that has worked fantastically in many instances.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And sometimes I have the feeling that this local, the importance of these local people gets kind of overstepped, but it's so integral because, yeah, they're your boots on the ground. They're your people who are really telling the story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And don't underestimate the amount of local traditional knowledge that these people have that can actually contribute to the engineering designs that you want to make. Sometimes there is a bit of a technocratic tendency of people from outside who know all the computer models to fix the situation for the people. And clearly they have a lot to add. But, well, the communities, they grew up there. They know what they want. They know what they need. And there often is a lot of knowledge in such communities that is really critical if you want to have a truly integrated engineering project in place.
Yeah, that's really powerful what you're saying now as well. And I think that that's somewhere where we can all improve. Maybe it's nice to mention in the opener, you talked about the project that you have with the Global Mangrove Watch, with the where you're using the satellite data. I think this is also a very interesting project. It's really, yeah, working with the tools and the information that we have available now. Could you tell us something about that project as well?
Yeah, that's the other side of the spectrum, the super high-tech work that we do in order to inform action on the ground. What we see is that there's a lot of satellite information available about mangroves and other coastal ecosystems, and a lot of that information provides really valuable information that policymakers and practitioners can use to inform their work. But what we do see is that it often gets stuck in the desks of the scientists who develop the nice maps and populate the data. And together with a number of partners, such as Aberystwyth University, Solo EO, the Nature Conservancy, and dozens of scientists from the world, we have established an initiative where we bring together dozens of geospatial data layers on status and distribution of mangroves, on their values, on their threats, real-time information also. So some data are refreshed every two weeks or every 4 weeks. And we have brought that together in an online data platform called Global Mangrove Watch. You can easily look it up online. And then we use artificial intelligence, cloud computing technologies, to kind of populate data from those background data, present the information in a format that is useful for practitioners. So then you don't need to be any longer a GIS expert to be able to access these data. With some very simple tools, you can navigate for your country, for your area, how many mangroves there are, whether there has been any illegal logging in the last few weeks, how much carbon sits in your mangroves. Well, and over time, we will be integrating many more data layers. And you can imagine that such decision support systems based on these data can really help us to not only prioritize or monitor our conservation efforts, but also be used as very powerful communications tools to raise awareness about why mangroves need more attention, why they are at least as valuable as the coral reefs that are maybe more sexy and have received more attention in the past, but where actually...
You don't have a Nemo in the mangroves.
We don't have Nemo in the mangroves, but we do have fantastic mudskippers, for example. We have manatees swimming around. There's the proboscis monkeys of Borneo living in the mangroves. There's the tigers in India living in the mangroves. So, well, I have sufficient examples to counter why I think mangroves are very important and need more attention.
And equally as sexy as coral reefs.
At least equally.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, yeah, so this is, it's twofold. So with DMAC, we really talked about why that project was so important to get that integrated on the local stakeholder level and to get the local communities working together there. And then, yeah, indeed, with the flip side of that, indeed, the absolute other end of the scale, how do we use data? How do we open up? How do we visualize it? And that's what we are having the same conversations with the climate risk overview tool that we developed. How do you bring this data forward so that you don't have to be a GIS expert? You just can put it on the table for the decision makers, for the policy makers, so that they can also understand what are the priorities and where do we need to focus on.
Absolutely. And yeah, I strongly believe that that model works because you provide the science base that you need in order to make well-informed decisions in, for example, designing your engineering projects. You have the models for community engagement that you need to, beyond consulting them on a project, to really make them part of your project and make them not just a stakeholder, but also an owner of your project. And well, if you then bring together experiences from different disciplines, partners from disciplines, you can also work across jurisdictions within the government to really deliver integrated approaches that are based on engagement and participation of a broad partner base and based on the best available knowledge. And I strongly believe that that is the future of engineering.
Yeah, I think that's a very powerful top. And I almost would like to end on that, but there was one final thing that I wanted to discuss with you. One of the critical elements is we have these very high level events, which are very driven by policy making. But as we've identified, you need both sides, you need to bring everyone together. How can we achieve this goal of making sure everyone is also on the table in these discussions at these big global policy making events like the climate summit in November?
Well, what I've observed at that global level, there's the climate summit, the UNISDR framework on disaster risk reduction, there's many more, that there actually is a really big buzz to promote nature-based solutions. There's increasing interest to do something with nature-based solutions, including building with nature, as a means to reach climate mitigation, adaptation, resilience targets. But what I also observed is that there's a lot of talking and there's no bridging yet between those who are able to actually implement these kind of large-scale integrated solutions on the ground. There's actually few examples of large-scale applications of these solutions, particularly in the developing world. And I think that's where Wetlands International, Van Oort, but also many of the other partners of the Building with Nature Consortium come in. Because we actually, through the innovation program in the last 10 years, have demonstrated that it is possible to implement these approaches through the market and also through pilots at scale. And what I think the main contribution can be of us as a collective is to help some of those very global targets that have been set to be translated to the ground through practical applications in the field and by driving these market projects. And this is also why, as a spin-off of the Building with Nature Indonesia project in DMAK, in the context of the Building with Nature program, we are now working to develop a Building with Nature Asia initiative. And the ambition of that program is to bring together international and also particularly local partners to collectively develop investment propositions for, well, what ultimately, hopefully, will be multi-billion euro investment in these kind of nature-based solutions. And this will not only move the engineering sector and the way we engineer our projects in a different direction, but it would also create big opportunities, including for Van Oort, to actually contribute their knowledge as a solution to some of the big societal problems we have in relation to, for example, climate change. So in a way, it offers also new business opportunities to develop solutions that are not just more sustainable, but ultimately create a much bigger benefit than what conventional projects could provide on their own. And I do believe that that is an interesting future to work towards.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Peter. And I think that it's an absolutely fantastic opportunity for Van Oord and for Wetlands to be a part of these discussions and to make these things move forward and to hopefully make some success stories, or many more success stories, the coming years. So thank you for those wise insights. Would you like to share any final parting thoughts with our listeners before we wrap up for today?
Well, knowing that many listeners will be from the engineering sector, it's just a call upon us to team up and to continue the good work that we've been doing already in promoting nature-based solutions, paying more attention to ecosystems as part of adaptation, mitigation, development approaches. Let's team up. Let's continue to work together. Let's also look outside the boundaries of Western countries. And feel free to get in touch. And I would very, very keen to explore where we can find each other.
That's great. Thank you, Peter. And what a fantastic way to close with teaming up. And I think that's a great common theme that we discuss through all of our podcasts. And I'm very much looking forward to the final and next episode in our podcast series, where I will talk with Lisa Hartog from the Ministry of Infrastructure and Water Management here in the Netherlands. And there we are also going to really talk about how we can accelerate action. And I assume teaming up will also be on the agenda with Lisa. So thank you very much, Peter. And thank you to our listeners for joining us.
Thanks, Rachel.